Well, good morning to you. I'll tell you what, I'm delighted to be here this morning, but I wish it was under different circumstances. I'm glad to hear that Pastor Greg seems to be recovering well, and we'll continue to pray for him. It means a lot that he comes back and comes back soon. I also come a little bit with a heavy heart. If you've been following the news, we had a mass shooting in El Paso, Texas yesterday in which at least 20 people were killed and many more injured. And then again early this morning, maybe about 1 o'clock in Dayton, Ohio, another mass shooting. So towards the end here, we will offer prayers for those folks and their families. Tough times in those cities. Okay, well, as it was mentioned, I attend regularly New Community Covenant in Logan Square, and although we have a very nice church, we have no air conditioning, so I'm used to kind of dressing like this to survive. So I apologize if I seem a little informal, but that's just because that's how we have to do it at summer there. But it's very comfortable here. I think we should all come over here in the summertime. It's great. So I want to talk to you this morning about something I get really excited about, and that is what I think is the very essence of the Christian life, and that is walking in faith. Faith is something that we have to rely on at multiple points in our life, multiple points. Think about the things that you might need guidance from God, such as, you know, at different points in your life, and this is going to apply whether you're 9 or 90, but there are different kinds of decisions you make at different ages. Should I marry that person or should I not? Where should I go to school? Will God help me find a job? What does God want me to do in the midst of retirement or in the midst of sickness? What is my purpose? We're always, always exploring that at all ages. I know when I was young, I thought by the time I'm my age, no problems, life is figured out, but you never quite get there, do we? It's always walking closely with God. So today what I want to do is make it very practical and emphasize the 7 principles of a life of faith. My wife and I have used these. We found them to be amazing, and they guide us in powerful ways. When I think about faith, we got to start with Moses, who I think about as the ultimate giant of the faith. And you're already there. Great. Thank you. She's too good. So Moses was like the ultimate amazing leader, right? Mighty, strong, confident, so close to God that he actually seemed to talk to him face to face, respected. Think about the kind of faith he had. He had the faith to go to the most powerful person on earth and say, "Free my people." And believe enough in God that he wouldn't get killed right there on the spot, which is usually what would happen. He had the faith to call down these powerful plagues, one after another, after another, after another, trusting God that he wouldn't make him look like a fool, and he would actually send those plagues. Can you imagine stating this is going to happen and then it doesn't? You'd look ridiculous. He had the faith to lead the Hebrews out of Egypt at incredible risk to every single man, woman, and child. He had the faith to hold up his staff when they were pinned in, the army pursuing them, they're at the Red Sea, and that God would truly part that Red Sea and keep it parted as they crossed. If it didn't work, all the people would die. Pretty heavy consequences. He had the faith that those Egyptians that were pursuing them wouldn't catch up with them, that somehow, as they got through the Red Sea, God would do something to prevent them from following. He had the faith that God would take them to the promised land, even though, as we know, it took many decades to get there. He had the faith day after day, and can you imagine this pressure, that God would provide food for the people every day. Manna, sometimes quail. Those were the special days. So he was a giant of the faith in multiple ways, so giant that God invited him multiple times to go to the top of Mount Sinai, and do what? Converse with him as if they're just buddies. And as you recall, not once but twice, God gave him the 10 commandments to bring down. He had such powerful faith and influence on his people that when they were at war, as long as he held his arms up, they would win. If he got tired and had to put them down, they would lose. So then, as you remember, people came and propped up his arms. He had that much connection and power through God. He had so much connection with God that God even told him exactly when and where he would die and told him, you won't get to go to the promised land, but at the moment just before your death, I will show you it. And indeed he did. So the Bible says that no prophet in Israel has ever been like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all these signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome details that Moses did in the sight of all of Israel. Can you imagine that? If that was written about you, no one has ever shown such power. Well, here's the deal. God seeks to work through us individually and collectively. Ultimately, for our full Christian witness in the world, it's going to take people of God willing to live lives of faith. Now, we're going to talk about this. Faith doesn't just mean I believe in God. Faith means I believe in God, therefore I will do this, believe this, and so on. Mother Teresa often quoted, you may have heard this before, she says, we're not called to be successful. We are called as Christians to be faithful. It is the essence of our existence as Christians. So what is faith? And if we can go to the next slide. It's a great place to go, the faith chapter, which is Hebrews 11, where they talk about the giants of the faith. And there it says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. What I want to emphasize here is that there's really two components to faith. One is their intellectual assent, okay? And the second is what we call trust in action. A lot of times we think of faith as trust, but faith has two components. So let me give an example. I can intellectually assent that that giant roaring, flip me upside down multiple times roller coaster is both safe and thrilling, but until I actually get on it, I'm not putting my faith into action yet, right? So a full expression of my faith is, I can see it's thrilling and it's safe. I believe that, and I will express it by getting on the roller coaster. That's the way our faith is, too. And a lot of times we want to stop at part one and not do part two. So faith ultimately means this. If it seems clear that God is telling us to do something, even if it seems crazy and makes no sense to anyone around us, we do it. End of story. That is a life of faith. So let's return briefly to Moses here, because I talked about Moses in the latter part of his life where he was this giant of faith. But he didn't start that way. In fact, he was a rather doubting Thomas kind of guy, clearly didn't think he had many talents, very convinced of his inadequacies, and quite fearful. So think back to the book of Exodus. We remember that Moses was adopted into royalty, right? Not just any royalty, the most powerful family on the face of the earth at that time. All right, so if any family on earth had everything that the world can offer, it was the family in which Moses was adopted into and raised in. Somewhere along the lines, he realized he is Hebrew, and when he saw injustices being done to the Hebrews, he reacted out of pure emotion, took action, and it cost him everything. He had to flee, right? Or he would have been killed by the family that raised him because he had rejected his adopted family. So he clearly gave up his silver tray. He fled. He started a new life. It's a pretty nice, solid life that he built. Remember, he tended flocks. He had a father-in-law, Jethro, so he married into a nice middle-class family, had children. He prayed to God. But then, living his nice life, this nice second life, is when that burning bush came. As he's just doing his job at the time, God calls with this incredible charge. And next slide, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt, he says to Moses. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Notice this call. You, singular Moses, who has fleed this place, go in and free an entire people. Go to the most powerful person on earth, the one that is already wanting to kill you, and say, free my people. So I think Moses is very human at this point, just like I would imagine I would be. What does he do? Does he say, sure? No, not at all. He's quite uncertain about himself, so he says to God, who am I? It's a good question. I mean, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt? I'm just a shepherd. I'm just tending to my flocks. God addressed his objections and said, you can do it, I've called you. Did that convince Moses? No, he responded, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? After God again answered his objections, Moses responded with yet another reason that God must have the wrong person. Pardon your servant, Lord, he says. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. I love this. He's telling God, yeah, I wasn't a very good speaker before, and ever since we've been dialoguing here, I haven't gotten any better. So I can't be your guy. God again, this is the third time now, met his objections, but Moses was not done objecting. This time he gets right to the point and he says, pardon your servant, Lord, please send someone else to do it. I am truly not your guy. It's kind of interesting because at this point it says that God got angry and Moses finally accepted his call. He was wholly inadequate for the task that he knew, but he was now willing to be obedient to God and live this life of faith. So you notice the difference here. The key is that he took his focus off of himself and what he can and can't do, and what he wanted to do and not wanted to do, and put his focus on God. All right? God, if you're saying you want me to do this, I know I can't do it, but I will follow you. So he might have said to himself many times from that point on, I can't, but you can. I can't, but you can. In fact, in my home church, we practice that as a breathing exercise. We breathe in, I can't. We breathe out, but you can. And we do that over and over. So now imagine the next few days. It's one thing to get this call, but Moses still lives in a community of people. He's married, he's got children, he's got a father-in-law he works for. How does he tell them? Well, being human, he first goes to his father-in-law, and he doesn't really tell him the whole truth, kind of a half-truth. He says that he wants to go to visit his people in Egypt, the Hebrews, just to see if they're still alive. So he doesn't give them anywhere near the whole story, does he? Jethro says, go ahead, and gives him a blessing. So then Moses and his wife, Zipporah, and their children, they get packed up to head to Egypt. Okay, can you imagine Zipporah here? This is my entirely made-up conversation between Moses and Zipporah. All right, so here's Moses coming to Zipporah. Hun, babe, sweet potato pie, my little buttercup. So I was talking to God the other day, and God said, funny guy, this God. Well, you know, what he said was that I'm supposed to go free the Israelites from the mighty Egyptians or something like that. You know, I might not have heard God quite right. Well, yeah, that's pretty much what he said. Okay, so what's Zipporah supposed to do with that? She's probably thinking, my husband has flipped his lid. He's a socket wrench short of a toolkit. Something. There's a problem here. I mean, we got a nice life. What are you talking about? You're going to go there, and, I mean, you'd be crazy not to think he's going to get killed, and we are, and herself and her children may be killed. Okay, but somehow, she trusted God, too. This call probably made no sense whatsoever, nor did God tell her directly what was to happen, as far as we can tell, but still, she trusted. To me, her faith may have been even greater than Moses, because of the risk she was going at without that burning bush in front of her. It's interesting that in Exodus 4, that says as they were on the journey to Egypt, Zipporah actually saved Moses' life by getting things right with God. So there were some issues there. If you're interested, go back to Exodus 4. So now we know the rest of the story. We talked about that. There's a complete transformation. Amazing miracles happen. The people are freed. They wander for many years, and eventually they get to the promised land. Notice that Moses transformed from this man who had all the world could offer. All the world could offer. Okay, in terms of everything you could think of. Then into this middle class life, which was a very good life, and stepped out on faith step by step as God called him. He transformed from this person that resisted multiple times, saying to God, I am not your man. I don't have the abilities. To where we read in the Bible, it says, the single greatest, most influential leader in the history of our faith. What I want to do here is just draw out the seven principles, then, of living life by faith. If you take notes, it would be great to write these down, and what I'd encourage you is to try to practice them, put them into practice tomorrow morning. Step one is the one you can do, and we'll see here in just a moment. So, step one in living a life by faith. Set a sacred space. Be in communion with God. We all know, and we hear this often, that we're supposed to be in devotion to God. Here's the thing. So God is always at work in the world. God always has things he is doing, trying to redeem people and call them to him. He's always pursuing with each of us a love relationship. And what God is asking is just in any other relationship we have that we return that by pursuing God. That's how relationships happen, right? The time we spend, we share things about one another. We are intimate in that way by talking to one another, things we wouldn't necessarily tell everybody. What will happen when we are in communion with God like that is God is going to want to invite us into the work he's doing. And when we are in communion, we will hear. We will be able to sense when God is calling us to that. How? It's going to be through the Holy Spirit speaking in multiple ways. Through Bible reading and devotions, through prayer, through circumstances that keep popping up that don't seem to make sense otherwise. In Moses' case, a burning bush, right? And through our church body, you will start to sense other people affirming something that's a call that you have. Genesis tells us that Noah was a righteous man, that he was seeking God. He walked faithfully with God. And it was in that faithful walk with God that God chose him to do the work that God was going to do anyway. Build this ark, save the animals, save a certain number of humans. Okay, so Moses was in communion. So you set a sacred space. For my wife and I, what we've done now is we get up a half hour earlier than we want to. We get ourselves ready, we have breakfast together, and then we push aside our plates and we spend about 20 minutes first doing a devotion together and then in prayer. We ask each other what should we be praying for, and that's how we do it. It actually works better for us than to just get up and immediately go into prayer because we're not quite awake yet, so that allows us to get awake. Yes. All right. Notice here that what we don't want to ask is, God, what is your will for my life? It's centered on us, right? We want to ask, God, what is your will? Drop off the for my life. God, what is your will? And when you ask God that, he will involve you in amazing things that God is doing. Second principle here. God speaks to us, but not always directly. So Moses is an instance of direct. Zipporah is an instance of indirect. When my wife and I were living and I was teaching at Bethel University up in St. Paul, Minneapolis, God gave me a call to go to Rice University down in Houston, Texas. And it's a fine university, but no way on God's green earth did I want to live in Texas. I'm from Minnesota originally and from here, and I don't like the climate of Texas and so on. But that God told me pretty directly, but not to my wife. So my wife had to hear it indirectly. And it's a lot harder when you have to hear it indirectly. But for some reason, God speaks in these different ways. Different tests, different ways of communicating, because God knows what we can and can't handle, I believe. So, third principle. Very important. God usually shows us just one step. So think about it. Abraham. What does Abraham get a call? He says, go from your country. Where, God? To the land I'll show you. So he's going to, again, like Moses, going to pack up his whole family and go. He don't even know what direction to go because God hasn't said, just said go. That's often how God works. And I think it's because God is looking for us to put faith in that first step. If he outlines the whole thing, either we'll shy away or we'll be too confident that we know and start losing our need for communion with God. So it's okay when you only know one step at a time. Fourth principle, huge one. When God invites us to do, what God invites us to do is often seems illogical, impossible, or unexplainable. Noah, build a really massive boat. Can you imagine, again, explaining to his family why he's doing that, or the neighbors? Have you ever heard a Well, Bill Cosby's been in trouble lately, but back in the day he had a funny bit on being Noah and what that must have been like, and his neighbors ridiculing him and so on. And again, Abraham, think of Abraham, I think it's the worst thing of all, where God says, I want you to take your one and only son Isaac up, and I want you to sacrifice him. Okay? What's amazing, and I hate this story, is that Abraham was obedient. It makes no sense. I can't imagine if I was called to do that. I would certainly end up in prison if I did that. But God was obviously in the end testing him. Would you have faith? And in the end, he didn't have him carry that out. So it's very important that we don't try to limit ourselves to what makes sense in the world's realm. We will have way too small of a faith then. We truly have to believe God works outside of the things we can see, smell, taste, and so on. Now here's the deal, and this is the fifth principle. When you get those kind of calls, you're going to enter what's called a moment of truth or a crisis of faith. You're going to be just like Moses was, like, I can't do that. That's just, I don't have the ability, that's too big, that's too crazy, I can't do it. This is the most important principle right here. This is the make or break time. Either you do or you don't. When I told you we had this call to move to Texas and we needed to be sure, we did something that pastors say don't do. So we sat down, my wife and I and children, and we prayed, and then we said, God, would you show us an answer? And we just opened up the text and went, all right, now I want you to remember where I was working, Bethel University. Here's what the verse said. Leave Bethel and go to the land I will show you. Couldn't be much clearer. Yep. Yeah. All right, God. 15 years we were there. Yes. Okay. If you can pass that threshold, that crisis of faith, and actually act on it, put your trust into action. The sixth is an important one, and that is be ready for identity changes. Often when God calls us to something, it's something big, it changes who we think we are. That's why we usually resist at front, because we have a sense of who we are, and we're limiting God. God's saying, I can have you be anybody I have created you to be. You think you're this, but I've created you for so much more. So following God often does necessitate a series of identity changes. Seventh is the best of all. When we can exercise these first six, we will live life and experience God more abundantly. I can say this for sure in our own life, that we know God much more deeply than we could have imagined. We realize how faithful God truly is, that when he gives a call, he never abandons us. He protects. He's given us some crazy calls on our family, but done incredible things for our children and their protection along the way. There's a Christian comedian named Mark Lowry, and he says, so here's life, kind of has its ups and downs, right? In Christian life, you get to live it more abundantly. So here's the Christian life. Yeah. And indeed, it is. It's more of everything. It's a wonderful experience. So let me summarize the seven principles then, just to repeat them. Set a sacred space where you're in communion with God. Pick a place where you're going to do it. That's your place. God speaks to us, but not always directly. God usually shows us just one step. God invites us to do often seemingly illogical, impossible, or unexplainable things. At that point, we'll enter a moment of truth, a crisis of faith. Be ready for identity changes if you follow God, and then be ready to experience life in God more abundantly, more deeply, more richly. So when we trust God, when we put our faith into action, that's when we see how God really works. God becomes ever more real to us. We're watching it happen. Amazing things happen. It's pretty simple, really. It's as old as the Garden of Eden. God outlines in his word how we're to live, and if we do that, we will have the most amazing lives. But the devil always comes along and says, don't believe it. It's a lie. It's meant to keep you from happiness, from security, from whatever it is you think you need or want. So let's just take 30 seconds to here to think about, what does the devil want for us? Because the devil's busy in the world working too, right? What the devil wants is for you to do anything but join God in God's work. I took an Uber over here this morning, and I got in my driver. I said, good morning. I said, are you just starting, or you've been doing this for a while? He says, yeah, I started at 4:30, but you're my last one. I'm going to drop you off and then head out to the lake and go water skiing. And then he proceeded to talk about his life. He's 53 years old, and he spends it entirely entertaining himself. He snow skis 100 days a year. He water skis whenever it's nice enough. You know, no sense of there's a God or a bigger purpose. It's just a life of entertainment. Well, that's very pleasing to the devil in this way. It keeps us from focusing on our true purpose. What does the devil want? What the devil wants for you is to live a life of mediocrity. No impact for Christ. What the devil wants is for you to pursue a comfortable, middle-class life, have lots of nice things. That will keep you occupied. What the devil wants for you is to focus on things like getting a good job, making money, getting yourself a nice widescreen TV, and watching your life away. What the devil ultimately wants is if you insist on living a life of faith, then what the devil wants is for you to have a very small, insignificant faith. To come to those moments of crisis of faith, and to say, no, I can't do that. It's not me. That just doesn't make sense. In those cases, then, that's exactly the best the devil can do at that point. Now, contrast that here with God. God has a passion that we don't waste our lives. Again, whether we're 9 or 90, it never ends. I was so impressed by Billy Graham. In his 90s, he's still serving the Lord with passion. God has a passion to see you join him in his work, be part of something huge, something transcendent, something life-changing. What God really wants is for us to live these radical lives of obedience to Christ. That's where the power comes from. And it's only by living these lives of faith, and the seven principles help us do that, that we will live the lives that God has designed us for. And here's the deal. When we do that, the end result is we change the world. And don't believe me? Go through the Bible and those who live their lives of faith and watch how powerful God worked through them and changed the society and the times through their faith. All right, well, let's close here in a prayer. Lord, for each of us and for us together, we commit to practicing lives of faith. We rejoice in your love for us and the fact that you pursue a relationship with us. Lord, help us to pursue a relationship with you. Speak to us, guide us, as you invite us into your work, as you call us and empower us to do more than we possibly can conceive. God, you have given the gift of life, and we seek to use that life by living through faith, not by sight. May your blessings and guidance pour down on each and every person here today. Amen.